Welcome to the Monitor Daily Podcast. It's Friday, June 11th. Thanks for joining us. I'm Noelle Swan, reading for Linda Feldman.
And I'm Ken Kaplan.
Anticipation is high and expectations low ahead of next Wednesday's summit between Presidents Joe Biden and Vladimir Putin. Such mixed emotions also marked this week's convening of the Dartmouth Conference, now in its seventh decade as the longest-running citizens' dialogue between prominent Americans and Russians. There was joy over the recent extension of New START, the last remaining U.S.-Russian arms control agreement. And delegates mourned the COVID-19-related passing of the beloved Orthodox priest in the Russian delegation, Metropolitan Feofan of Kazan. The pandemic also forced this week's dialogue onto Zoom. Matthew Rozhansky, director of the Kennan Institute and a conference organizer, said in an email, "This was a unique undertaking. To come together and speak frankly and productively to one another, despite the long-distance virtual format and despite the acute tensions in the relationship today, was very powerful." The suite of crises in U.S.-Russian ties, from Ukraine and Belarus to cyber attacks and election interference, has only grown since Linda joined the Dartmouth Dialogues in 2015. Thankfully, their discussions, led by veterans of diplomacy, avoided going down polemic rabbit holes. Instead, the more fruitful areas of engagement remain in civil society, among librarians, physicians, religious leaders, and now a new working group, firefighters. One can imagine common ground on the issue of wildfires, faced increasingly by both countries amid climate change. But J.P. Natkin, a battalion chief in New York's Westchester County and leader of the U.S. Dartmouth Fire and Emergency Services team, tells Linda the focus is much broader to share ideas on training and techniques and to build ongoing relationships. Mr. Natkin says, "The fire service is like a giant global fraternity and sorority. Whenever I travel, I always go to the firehouse. You go in, you have coffee, you talk. They're my brothers and sisters." Now, today's stories. Our first story. Iran's conservative power brokers, fearing they could not win a fair election, are tipping the scales like never before, upsetting the balance between Islamic and republic aspects of the regime.
Iran's looming presidential election comes at a challenging time for the Islamic Republic. Economic hardship has prompted lethal protests. Hopelessness about the future is pervasive and apathy widespread. Campaigns to boycott the election have taken root. With the regime's popular legitimacy appearing in the balance, the result has been a crisis of confidence among conservative power brokers and an unprecedented lurch away from democratic practices. The first sign that this election would be like no other came when the powerful Guardian Council announced a shortlist of vetted candidates, rejecting well-known centrists, reformists, and most other conservatives, and ensuring that the hardline judiciary chief who lost the last election will be virtually uncontested. The second sign has been officialdom's relative indifference to voter turnout, a metric portrayed in every election since the 1979 Islamic Revolution as proof of legitimacy. Little is being done to combat the boycott campaigns, as if that vote of confidence were no longer achievable. Trending on Twitter is the hashtag in Persian, "No way I vote." Irvand Abrahamian, a historian of modern Iran, says, "The rational thing to do when things go wrong is try to open up, to get more public support. But if you narrow yourself down, it's just alienating more people." The story was reported by Scott Peterson in London for The Monitor.
The performances of the last five presidents at NATO summits have molded and influenced how Europe views the alliance's leader and the United States. Our reporter, Howard LaFranchi, witnessed them all.
In 1989, after a meeting of NATO heads of state, when British reporters asked the NATO staffer at President George H.W. Bush's press conference if there would be a translation for Bush speak, it was indeed amusing. "But for me," writes Howard, "covering my first meeting of NATO leaders, the snickering also risked obscuring the really big accomplishment Mr. Bush sensed was in reach, a peaceful end to the Cold War and a reunited Germany. Now, 30-plus years and a long line of summits later, I'm back in Brussels for the debut of President Joe Biden. And that has had me thinking back over the NATO meetings I attended, featuring Mr. Biden's five predecessors, the first Bush, then Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and Donald Trump. Every event has been an opportunity to witness how each president was playing in Europe, and moreover, to gauge their impact on European public opinion's assessment of the United States. If a new Pew Research Center poll released this week is any indication, Mr. Biden is already off to a good start. Still, he might follow in the footsteps of some past presidents and do something to keep the good vibes going." This story was reported by Howard LaFranchi in Brussels for The Monitor.
Coronavirus passes could become the new normal in Europe, even as the U.S. balks at the idea. The difference comes down to circumstances and values and will shape post-pandemic global mobility.
Starting July 1st, all European Union member states will accept the EU Digital COVID Certificate, also known as the Green Passport, as proof of vaccination against COVID-19, recently tested negative, or recovered from the disease. The scheme got a resounding yes at the European Parliament on June 9th. But across the Atlantic, the idea faces strong headwinds, whether for travel or domestic use. The Biden administration has ruled out introducing vaccination passports, and some states even banned them. Freedom and fears of government overreach underpin the rejection of vaccine certificates in the U.S., while European societies have grappled more with issues of privacy and fairness. And so as Western countries savor a return to the old, this phase of post-pandemic mobility is being shaped by cultural attitudes and the initial responses to the pandemic. Anders Herlitz, a researcher at Sweden's Institute for Future Studies, points out, "Alabama never closed the border to Mississippi in the way Finland closed the border to Sweden. Here in the EU, the vaccine passports are seen as a necessary evil to get rid of other, much more extensive limitations to people's freedom, whereas in the U.S., they would not help getting rid of other limitations, but only cause new limitations." This story was reported by Dominique Sogel in Basel, Switzerland, Sarah Miller-Jana in Toronto, Lenora Chu in Berlin, and Yanis Orestes Papadimitriou in Athens for The Monitor.
Asking the rich to pay more in taxes has long been broadly popular in the U.S. in the name of fairness. President Biden and a bombshell IRS leak kindle new debate over how to do it.
Sympathy for small business owners often goes hand in hand with distrust of government and the taxation that pays for it. But polling shows that while Americans celebrate wealth creation, they believe the rich pay too little in taxes. President Joe Biden has proposed a boost in the capital gains tax on investments, coupled with removing a special tax break on inheritance for the wealthy. Currently, when someone sells an inherited asset, the original value is stepped up to the date of inheritance, not its original cost. The Biden plan eliminates the step up. ProPublica reported Tuesday that the richest 25 Americans paid little or no income tax from 2014 to 2018, thanks to a tax code that rewards capital income, according to leaked IRS data. The vast majority of Americans would be unaffected by Mr. Biden's proposed changes, since they inherit too little wealth to be subject to the estate tax. "People like the idea that someday all this will be yours," says Ray Madoff, a law professor at Boston College who studies estate planning and tax policy. "But the big tax debate, is about the super wealthy of America who are subject today to minimal tax liability. The story was reported by Simon Montlake for The Monitor.
Like many Americans, our culture writers have longed to get back into theaters. The new Lin-Manuel Miranda musical, In the Heights, offered a chance for two of them to compare notes on what film has to say about this moment. Tyler is a student of theater who's seen Hamilton multiple times. Stephen has never seen it. Spoiler alert, they say the movie, directed by John M. Chu, offers a dazzling reminder of the purpose of art during times of darkness. It manages to be both larger than life and life-affirming. You can read both reviews in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. Now, commentary from the Monitor's editorial board on the world's response to Ethiopian famine. 7 months after a war broke out in Ethiopia, it remains unclear how many civilians have been killed. Estimates vary widely, but something is known. Ethiopia's military and its allies have burned stores of seeds, destroyed farm equipment, and killed oxen and even aid workers trying to deliver food. In other words, they have used starvation as a tool of war. And indeed, on June 10th, the United Nations declared a famine exists for an estimated 350,000 people in Tigray. The tactic of conflict-induced hunger is not new in the history of warfare. What is new for Ethiopia's famine is that the global community has an additional tool to prevent the weaponization of food. 3 years ago, the UN Security Council passed a resolution that, for the first time in the Council's history, condemned starvation as a form of warfare and declared it a war crime. More importantly, it empowered the UN to impose sanctions on individuals and entities that obstruct aid to hungry civilians in a war zone. The war in Tigray represents another chance for the world to break the link between war and starvation. The increasing strength of humanitarian law can finally do it. That's a wrap for the news. You can find the full-length versions of these stories in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. Thank you for joining us today. Please come again Monday when the Monitor's diplomatic correspondent, Howard Franke, reports on the future of NATO from the summit in Brussels. In today's Christian Science Spiritual Perspective, our contributor shares how dissatisfaction, uncertainty, and misplaced hopes yield to joy, peace, and progress when one turns wholeheartedly to divine love. You can find the column in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. We want to give a quick thanks to our staff, including today's audio production team, Jeff Turton and Ure Okike.
This podcast is produced by the Christian Science Monitor. Copyright 2021.